Hi, I'm Michelle Shepard, host of Uncover Sharmini from CBC Podcasts. In 1999, 15-year-old Sharmini Anandaville disappeared on her way to a job that police believed didn't exist. 4 months later, her remains were found in a wooded ravine. I revisit the case that has stayed with me for over 20 years, ever since I first covered it as a cub crime reporter for the Toronto Star. You can find Uncover Sharmini on CBC Listen or on your favorite podcast app.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Lisa Bryn Rundel. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
fault lines. Two senior Israeli military officers are fired after the deadly strikes on World Central Kitchen staff. The IDF calls the strikes a grave mistake. A former Israeli foreign policy advisor calls it, quote, sheer stupidity that could alter the course of this conflict.
A lot on the line. After a California judge orders the U.S. government to provide shelter to migrant children in border camps, we'll ask a doctor and civil rights lawyer what it'll mean for the families she's trying to help.
Rocking the vote, an Indigenous woman in Alberta tells us how it will feel to participate in banned elections for the very first time next week after her years-long legal fight to have her voting rights restored.
Freedom of the depressed, a pet parrot at Halifax's Maritime Museum is making a long journey to join a flock of other macaws in a bid to improve his mental health.
Fish out of water after a tanker truck in Oregon filled with more than 100,000 live salmon crashed. All those fish had to flip-flop for their lives, leaving our guests' team to check every Chinook and cranny for survivors.
And sticking together, aficionados of all things stick have come together on Instagram to form Stick Nation. And their leaders are here to reveal what led them to branch out in this particular direction. As It Happens, the Friday edition, radio that knows they gather sticks, but wonders if they keep a log. Israel's military has dismissed two senior officers and says Monday's deadly strikes on international aid workers resulted from a, quote, serious violation, unquote, of its procedures and commands. In an initial report, the IDF says its officers failed to identify the cars as belonging to World Central Kitchen and misidentified its aid workers as Hamas militants. Alon Pincus is a former Israeli diplomat and foreign policy advisor. We reached him in Tel Aviv.
Alon Pincus, the Israeli military, as you've likely seen, has called this attack a, quote, grave mistake. As you looked at this initial report, how would you describe it?
Well, it's like the Hanlon's razor adage. Nothing that can be explained by stupidity should be regarded as malice, or the other way around. Meaning that it was not intentional, it was not malicious. But I do think it was sheer stupidity. The IDF had no business whatsoever conducting a military operation in an area. They knew the World Central Kitchen was conducting a humanitarian activity. I believe the military when it says it didn't mean. I believe that the intelligence was faulty. I believe them when they said that there was a break in the chain of command or in the trickling down of orders, but it does not absolve them from the stupidity of it all.
We know these cars were clearly labeled World Central Kitchen. The charity would have had to clear their location and all of the movements as well with military officials. World Central Kitchen has said that they were targeted. That's how they've put it. They felt targeted in those deadly moments. So it's hard for people to wrap around their brains. How could the military, the IDF, not know who they were and why they were there?
Oh, they did know. But there was faulty intelligence as to a suspected Hamas member that was joining them. But to be honest with you, I don't accept that as a reasonable explanation either, because the moment the World Central Kitchen, the WCK, cleared their activity with the IDF, which they did. As long as their convoy was marked, which it was, and as long as Israel knew the exact time and the exact route of that convoy, which it did, it doesn't matter who was there and how wanted he or they were. Israel should have refrained from any military activity. So that explanation, while it makes a technical sense, it certainly does not exonerate the IDF.
Yeah, the IDF also said in their release, quote, the forces did not identify the vehicles in question as being associated with WCK. Following a misidentification by the forces targeted the three WCK vehicles based on the misclassification of the event and the misidentification of the vehicles. I just wanted to underline those words, misidentification and misclassification.
I understand that.
Yeah.
I understand that. But here's the problem that I have with that explanation. The very same day, Israel targeted a building in Damascus hosting four senior Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. The intelligence there was flawless. The accuracy was 100%. The execution was impeccable. So how, on the same day, does Israel misidentify the convoy? I'm sorry. I've been in the military. I'm an Israeli. I'm a patriot. I just cannot accept this as a reasonable explanation.
And in terms of the response, we know the IDF has dismissed two senior officers involved and reprimanded three others. The speed of the response, the actions, those dismissals and reprimands, as I said, there have been other cases. You know, the UN pointed out again today, more than 220 humanitarian workers have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. But specifically in terms of IDF, you know, before the war, Shirin Abu Akleh was killed. The Reuters journalist since October 7th is just one of the journalists killed. What do you make of this response compared to what you've seen from the IDF in other cases? Why is it different in this case?
Because of the severity of the case, because the entire world was watching, because it was glaring in its stupidity, because the American president was outraged by it, quote unquote. These are his words. And so Israel realized that you got to take one on the chin and that there needs to be a quick apology and a quick mea culpa before things escalate.
WCK is also calling for an independent commission to investigate these killings, saying the IDF, quote, cannot credibly investigate its own failure in Gaza, end quote. Do you believe that that kind of independent investigation will actually happen?
No. I mean, I think the Israeli military investigation is going to provide the answers that we're looking for, and the answers that we're looking for are that it was a debacle on every level. An independent inquiry will not necessarily have access to all the military command and control orders and communications. And so I would rely on the IDF, but again, it's a foregone conclusion. It is their fault, period.
But what do you think will change, if anything, Alon? We've certainly seen international condemnation before. This might be stronger and louder for some reasons that you listed there. But is anything actually going to change? Is this going to be what pivots things?
There's a possibility here that this is a case of the so-called strategic corporal, quote unquote. What is a strategic corporal? It's when a corporal, meaning any field level, it could be a corporal, but it could also go up to major or lieutenant colonel, makes a tactical error, a tactical miscalculation, or is callous and reckless in a way that has a strategic impact on the dynamics of the conflict of the war. And I think this could be a case in which this one incident, this one tragedy, could actually precipitate a ceasefire. I'm not optimistic or pessimistic about this. I'm just saying this could prove to be a game changer.
Alon Pinkas, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Alon Pinkas is a former Israeli foreign policy advisor and military attaché. We reached him in Tel Aviv. It feels like a moment that should have happened in a bygone era. Next week, A woman in Alberta will be allowed to cast a ballot in her local election for the first time. And she's not alone. Karen McCarthy is a member of the Saddle Lake Cree Nation and lives on Whitefish Lake First Nation, number 128, north of Edmonton. Last year, she won a federal court case that saw voting rights restored to her and other female band members. For decades, those rules stripped Indigenous women who married non-Indigenous men of their Indian status, and thus their right to participate in choosing band leaders. They were overturned federally in 1985, but upheld in Ms. McCarthy's community until she challenged them. We reached Karen McCarthy in Edmonton.
Karen, seeing our names on a voter's list is something a lot of people take for granted. In this case, seeing your name on the Whitefish Lake First Nation voter's list, what was that like?
So when I saw my name and my son and my daughter's name on the voter's list, it was just a sense of accomplishment. And at first it didn't really hit me. When I looked, I had to verify first, of course. So I made the effort to go to where the voters list was posted, and I looked. I took a picture of it, and as I was leaving and driving away, that's when I really was very emotional. I thought about my journey to get to that point, so it was very bittersweet.
And you had to go up against the community that you love being a part of and want to participate in. You had to go up against that community to get to this point. How did you navigate that? How did you deal with that?
Well, I think because I have so much self-confidence and because of my education in First Nations governance, I was really confident and I know my rights. I knew it was going to be an uphill battle because, you know, of community influences and the discrimination I experienced for decades. So it was a tough decision because I actually did appeal the election in 2017. But because I was newly back into the community, I didn't feel like it was the right time to take it a step further and go to federal court. And so I figured, okay, well, let's see what they do in the next election. Let's see how this new chief and council does. But they didn't do anything in regards to making changes.
You stepped in. This dates back to the fact that your mother married a man who was not Indigenous. The federal government changed its rules, stripping people like your mother of Indian status back in 1985. So the federal government made that change. What was at the crux of this that forced you into a position where you had to go to court to restore your family's voting rights?
Well, it's just the lack of a willingness from the leaderships, term after term, of not willingly wanting to make those changes.
Why weren't they willing?
I feel that a lot of it is due to the leadership wanting to keep the voters list small, to keep the eligible people who can run for council small, so that way the same people can get in and retain leadership.
As part of its decision last year, the federal court also struck down a provision barring people in common law relationships from running for elected office on the Whitefish Lake First Nation. Where did that rule originate?
Well, that qualifying rule in our election code originated from actually 1955. So our election code was very old and outdated. So if you go back to those years, you know, there's a lot of issues in general, like Native people, Indians, were not allowed to vote in federal or provincial elections. So there was a lot of, you know, issues back then, discriminatory issues that just carried forward because no one challenged them. And so when Saddle Lake, because we're a sister nation to Saddle Lake, they had already experienced opposition to that in a court case that a person who opposed that discrimination because of the common law issue. So Saddle Lake already won that, but Whitefish would not honor that court decision. So when they made the same decision to not allow Lorna Jackson Little Wolf to run because she was in common law, she also took it to judicial review.
You're certainly not the only one who will benefit now from this and be able to be on the voters list, people who haven't been able to before. What are they saying to you in response?
Yes, there's several hundred people that were not allowed to vote. So I've had lots of positive feedback, people really happy. And it's been like that since I started it. When people found out I was doing this, they were really glad. In fact, the other day, I was on APTN, and as soon as it aired, I received a call from Chief Casey Bird from Paul Band congratulating me on winning my case, as well as acknowledging the work that I did to get to the point where I did, because there's people in his nation and women in his nation, families in his nation, that cannot vote because of changes that his nation did, that he says, I want people to stand up and do what you did as well in my community.
When the vote happens, what is what is it going to feel like, do you think, for you to be able to mark those ballots?
Well, it's I'm just so looking forward to it. I just feel like it's just such an accomplishment. You know, it's just, even talking about it, I just feel very, very excited and just really happy that I accomplished that. And I just did this for the right reasons, you know, and justice was served. So I'm just so looking forward to it.
Your mother's certainly been waiting a long time for this. How did she react?
My mom is my biggest supporter. She's going to vote in the next Satellite election next year. So she's happy. My sister, my brother, my older brother is very, very excited. He texts with me all the time and keeps up to date with the news. And they're just really proud and excited for all of us.
Karen, congratulations, and thank you for your time.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you allowing me the chance to tell my story.
Thanks, Karen.
Karen McCarthy is a member of the Saddle Lake Cree Nation and a newly minted voter in the Whitefish Lake First Nation number 128. We reached her in Edmonton. Considered what makes for a really high quality stick. Unless you're a dog or a child, probably not. But there are people, adult humans, I should specify, who think about sticks a lot.
Stick Nation, we got a good one. See how it's almost like a helix? It's like half of a DNA strand. The grain is just beautiful. It's cascading down, almost waterfall-esque. These quirky knots here actually add to the overall stickter scales. Smells like sage, some eucalyptus in there too.
That was Boone Hoag reviewing a stick, as in a piece of a tree, on an Instagram account he created with his buddy Logan Juggler called Official Stick Reviews. We reached Boone in Ogden, Utah, and Logan in Lake Havasu City, Arizona.
Boone, Logan, I have to say I feel kind of an affinity to what you're doing here, but I didn't know that you existed till recently. As much as I love sticks, though, I didn't create an Instagram site or a community around it. Why did you want to do this?
We started it out of, it felt kind of like being kids again.
Yeah.
And so when we started the stick page, we felt that there must be other people out there who like sticks, and we were right.
And was it one day you were walking and it sort of that aha moment happened?
Logan, you want to take that one?
So last year I was on a trip with some friends up in Montana, and we were kind of messing around with this stick on the banks of this river. And my friend was drawing with the stick in the sand, and he was saying how nice it felt in his hand.
Mm-hmm.
And then we each kind of grabbed the stick and started doing that, and we were like, oh, wow, that actually is really nice. Later that year, a bunch of other friends, we were down on a trip in Moab, Utah, and we found a stick. This one just happened to be shaped like a gun, and a similar thing happened where we picked it up, and we were just kind of joking around about how nice it felt in the hand. Part of it was a joke, but then part of it was true, where we were like, oh, yeah, it actually is a nice stick, really going in depth about why it was a good stick.
And then that led to the reviews and the Instagram page?
We filmed a review of the stick we found, and then I edited it the next morning, and it just kind of felt right. It kind of felt like really wholesome right off the bat. So then we just started doing it every day after that.
And Boone, it turns out that you were clearly not alone. There are a lot of stickheads out there, as they are known, apparently. Who makes up this stick nation?
So currently, I feel like we have stickheads, as we call them, all over the globe. People have submitted sticks from South Korea to Morocco to Chile to Canada, just all over the globe. It's been really surprising how many people out there really have an affinity and enjoy sticks. And so I'm really excited that we have a space for people to come together over sticks. It's kind of funny, but it's wholesome.
It's pretty wholesome, yeah. What, we were looking through your Instagram feed, and you know, one of the comments caught our eye. One person wrote, "For 2 years during the pandemic, I collected and drew sticks. Everyone thought I was nuts."
Yeah, and we get quite a bit of comments like that. Logan, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I was just going to say we get people like that all the time that are leaving us comments about how, yeah, they found their tribe, or they were like, "I knew I wasn't the only one who loved sticks like this."
Logan, let me ask you, we heard some clips there about some sticks that you guys like and what you like about them. But what, you know, are there rules? Is there a list, or you just know it when you see it?
So there are a number of tests that you can do when you find a stick. One of them is the McMurray-Benz test. Another one is called the Tennyson Curve Scale. A new one that just drops today, actually, is called the Williams Whacker Meter. That one deals with how well it is with whacking.
And Boone, as wholesome and happy as this international community is, there is some serious debate in your stickhead community about mods and natties. What's that all about?
So a modded stick is one that has been carved, it's been cut out of a tree. Some have designs cut into them, and then natties are all natural. So those are sticks that have fallen from a tree naturally and have not been altered at all. And Stick Nation and stickheads, there's a debate, and I'm not being over the top here. There's been an actual debate on our page of which stick is better. And we do a Stick of the Month tournament at the start of each month. And people have been calling for modded sticks to be disqualified. They're very passionate about it.
Well, I have to say, I mean, I'm team natty all the way. That's the whole point. You find it in nature, and it's beautiful as it is. I mean, if it's modified at all, maybe it's modified by its surroundings, or if it's on a beach, you know, from the sand and the waves.
Yeah, you sound like a true stickhead.
I did not know.
I'm happy you found us.
I'm happy I found you, too. We actually have, I mean, I just always thought of it as a piece of driftwood, but when we first moved to Vancouver, BC, when I was little, my dad found a stick, I guess we can call it, perfectly shaped. Mm-hmm. We still have it all of these decades later. It's
amazing.
You know, part of our house. Yeah.
We got to see that stick you got. We need a review from you.
It's perfect. I don't need anybody's review, but if I can dig up a picture, I may submit it. We'll see. Is there one that you have that's a favorite, Logan?
Oh, it's hard to say. There's so many good ones that we get every day. I do like the one that you played the clip of, the one that Boone found where the Tennyson curve scale was mentioned. That one's got to be a favorite. But really, we get so many that are, like, all day we'll get, you know, like 20 or 30 DMs at a time of just people sending in their sticks. And it's like every day you see a new one and you're like, that's actually a great stick.
Boone, Logan, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, take care.
Thank you.
That was Boone Hoag and Logan Juggler, the creators of Official Stick Reviews on Instagram and TikTok.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart. And for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Thousands of children in migrant camps along the U.S.-Mexico border have been living in limbo. The Biden administration has argued it has no duty to find shelter for them before they and their families have been processed by U.S. agencies. But now a California judge has disagreed. On Wednesday night, Judge Dolly M. Gee found that the kids in camps were in the legal custody of the Department of Homeland Security. Whether they had been processed, Kusichen teaches emergency medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. She's also a lawyer who sits on the board of the nonprofit group Border Kindness. We reached her in San Francisco.
Doctor, what will this court decision really mean? What will it change for the children your organization has been trying to help?
We are hopeful that this court decision will dramatically improve the conditions that these extremely vulnerable children are currently experiencing. As of right now, they're not given any food or water or warm clothes, or for even the smallest of babies, no infant formulas, no diapers. This court decision will change all of that, hopefully.
How quickly, you know, we know that the judge ordered Homeland Security to act, quote, expeditiously. How quickly could those basic necessities be given to them?
That is the sticking question. Mm-hmm. We never know what the actual implementation of any policy or judgment passed really entails. We're hoping that with this court decision, CBP and the federal government will act very judiciously and expedite the care that has been otherwise withheld for over a year now.
That's CBP, is Customs and Border Protection, just for our listeners. In the meantime, organizations such as yours have been trying to fill the gap, give people what they need. But as you visited these sites along California's southern border, just describe what you've seen and the kind of shape these children are in. How are they surviving?
Yeah, so these outdoor detention sites vary dramatically. You know, some are in the bleakest of desert environments, and individuals there, including children and babies, are experiencing extreme temperature fluctuations. So for instance, as of this morning, even though they're technically in San Diego County, California, it was snowing and hailing even as of this morning. You know, some of these other sites are sandwiched between enormous iron walls of, you know, the U.S.-Mexico border, with only a narrow 1-foot gap through which, you know, our only ability as volunteers is to pass, you know, water and food through these extremely narrow gaps. And when we see someone in extremis, we can't even reach them or touch them, which is extremely disheartening and despairing. These sites can vary dramatically, as I said, and most of them are miles from the nearest paved road. And so, you know, Border Patrol vehicles and our vehicles have gotten stuck on the way and out of these unpaved dirt roads that are frequently up a mountain. And so the conditions vary dramatically. And for extremely vulnerable people, medically vulnerable people, including children, including babies, these conditions are extremely dangerous. We have seen malnourished, undernourished children. We have seen children in, you know, sometimes parents make the decision to travel with children who have medical needs, right? Medical, psychiatric, emotional needs, because the U.S. is a bastion of healthcare and safety. And that also means, though, that these children are extremely vulnerable on their journey, and then end up here in these open air detention sites.
Yeah, the image you paint is quite striking and sad, frankly, when you think of young children there. But then there are what people are saying, the conversations. What are they telling you?
So I think one myth that I'd like to dispel is sort of who is crossing the border right now. We typically think of young, healthy, you know, Spanish-speaking men are crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. What I've seen again and again, it's couldn't be further from the truth than that currently. The global migration patterns have changed dramatically in the last year. you know, a third to a half of migrants crossing are actually from China and speak exclusively Chinese. I've met a significant number of people fleeing Turkey and speak only Kurdish because of the political destabilization that's going on there. You know, I've met people from Georgia as recently as last week, you know, Georgia, the country, not the state. And so we're really seeing what political destabilization, economic collapse, you know, what other countries are feeling acutely across the world really arrive at America's doorstep.
The judge has ordered an interim report by May 10th on this. What do you hope to see by that point?
I hope to see more of a protocolization of what happens, particularly with families and young children and unaccompanied minors crossing. I hope to see that there's a lot more transparency in these numbers and the protocols that are being placed. I think that's been a real difficult piece in trying to provide care and some sort of safety to such a large group of individuals. I know, you know, my experiences in sort of the more emergent medical cases that I've seen, including the death of a 13-year-old in the area, you know, the federal government and the local state and county governments hadn't really been working together and figuring out, you know, what happens in these emergent circumstances, right? And we're still seeing some difficulty and some lapse in conversation. It has improved. But overall, there just has to be a coming together at the table of, you know, both federal and local governments trying to figure out, you know, who has true ownership, which now with this judgment, it's definitely the federal government. But then also next steps, like how we can make sure that no other child dies in these areas.
Dr. Cheng, I thank you for your time.
Dr. Teresa Cheng teaches emergency medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. She's also a civil rights lawyer who sits on the board of the nonprofit group Border Kindness. We reached her in San Francisco. Rivu Rashid is best known to listeners in Labrador as the host of CBC's Labrador Morning. The life cycle of a salmon is a turbulent one. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, roughly 1% of salmon eggs make it to adulthood because before they can get there, they have to get through the smolt stage when juveniles take their long, arduous journey from freshwater to the sea. For a group of smolts in Oregon, that journey was made even harder after a tanker transporting them crashed. Now, just to be clear, an enormous truck isn't usually part of a smolt's journey. But these fish were part of a program that aims to help the dwindling salmon population by giving them an assist. The tanker held over 100,000 live young salmon when it flipped onto its roof, spilling its contents onto the roadside, but also into a nearby creek. Andrew Gibbs is a hatchery coordinator for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We reached him in La Grande, Oregon.
Andrew, this is the kind of story when you read it, it's hard to believe. When you got the call that this had happened, did you believe it?
Well, you know, my initial thought was it was an April Fool's prank from some of my staff. But then I realized it wasn't April Fool's yet. And I could tell by the tone of the voice of the person that called to notify me that it wasn't a joke, but it's just one of those calls nobody ever wants to get, whether, you know, it's someone you work with or a family member that's been in an accident. It's never a fun call to receive.
Because this was an attempt, you've described it as a fish taxi, to save them, to protect them.
Yeah. So basically the truck was hauling salmon Chinook smolts to be released in different watersheds, so different drainages, and the intent is to have those fish in places where the populations aren't as strong as we'd like them, and then with the hope that they will interbreed and and repopulate, in addition to mitigate for some of the losses that are created by the Columbia River hydro system.
So when you get that call and you hear that tone in their voice, did you think, you know, all is lost? These fish are gone.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I guess, the, you know, first thing. I mean, I was mainly wanted to get a status on the driver. And fortunately, he was just minor injuries. And so he was okay. And so then after we confirmed that he was okay, then we started the next steps in the response to get down there to see if fish were all lost or if there's ability to save some of them, and started that process.
How many of these salmon survived of the 100,000?
We recovered 25,529 fish that were hand counted as mortalities from the either in the tanker or laying on the bank from when the truck overturned. And so that puts roughly about 77,000 fish made it into the creek. Part of the tanker was hanging directly over the water, so those fish probably dropped right in, and then some of them probably, you know, wriggled their way down the bank and made it into the water, and presumably about 77,000 survived.
77,000 survived. That sounds extraordinary to me. Does it surprise you, or does it just underline to you what you already knew about salmon?
If as long as they get in the water, they're pretty hardy animals, and so they, you know, it's, I guess it's not terribly surprising. We did start encountering some of the smolts that were incidentally released downstream quite a ways near the mouth of where the Grand Ronde meets the Snake River within 24 hours. So those fish, they hit the water and they started doing what they are programmed to do, which is migrate out to the ocean.
So they're free, they're gone. What happens with this project now?
So it'll continue as normal. You know, the fish that were, you know, released into Looking Glass Creek represented 20% of the fish that we normally release in the Omaha River, which is the destination of those fish that that were in the overturned tanker. And so, you know, we will still receive, you know, return adults from the, you know, the 80% of the production goal in the Omaha in the future. And then the fish that survived and ended up in Looking Glass Creek will likely return to Looking Glass. I expect most of them to return in 2026 after spending 2 years foraging in the ocean.
This program has been in place. I know you've been doing this work for about a decade, but the program itself has been in place since the 80s. As you've been doing this work, how have you seen things shift with these salmon?
You know, there's been a lot of changes. I mean, it's a recovery program for a threatened population, and so, you know, we've tried a lot of different things to see, you know, what works better, what's going to return the most fish as adults, what's going to have the highest survival. So over the years, you know, we've tried, you know, releasing in different places to see if one particular habitat is more successful, releasing at different sizes to see if there is an optimum size that maximizes survival. You know, the timing that they are released, you know, if there's that perfect date where they'll get released and they'll head straight out and it, you'll get to the ocean with a higher rate of survival. So we've tried a lot of those different things over the years, and, you know, the stuff that works, we continue to do, and the stuff that didn't work, we change up and try something new.
And this crash, I know, and I'm glad you mentioned the driver is doing okay. What has this made you think about how you execute this plan in the future, as rare as an accident like this is?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I want to call this incident kind of a one-off event, but, you know, it's really just going to probably create an environment of, you know, hypervigilance when the staff is driving those fish tankers, just knowing that, you know, there was an incident, and it's going to probably, you know, make people pay more attention you know, be more focused on the road and avoid distractions, and hopefully just create a culture of, you know, safety-mindedness.
Andrew, glad we could speak. Thank you.
Thank you.
Andrew Gibbs is hatchery coordinator for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We reached him in La Grande, Oregon. Most of us can agree on one thing coming out of the pandemic. It sucked. And a close second, it was lonely. And it turns out Merlin the parrot found that period lonely too. Merlin has been the mascot for the Maritime Museum in Halifax since 2006. When the pandemic hit and the crowd stopped paying him visits, Merlin began to show signs of stress, biting at his feathers with his beak, for instance. And though the people have since returned, his spirits haven't bounced back. So the museum has decided it's time for Merlin to start a new chapter. Later this month, he'll make the trip to Fort Erie, Ontario, to join a flock of other macaws. Here's Maritime Museum manager Kim Reinhart speaking to reporters about the move.
It's actually really happy news, but it's also sad. We love Merlin very, very much, and Merlin's been a part of the museum family here since 2006. He was hatched in captivity and spent the first couple of years of his life in a busy pet store. So he was used to a lot of people coming and going, and he's been a great addition to the museum. Unfortunately, around the time of the pandemic, during the pandemic, Merlin's began showing behavioral changes. You can see he doesn't have all of his feathers. He has a sort of a nervous twitch, is what we kind of understand, of breaking off some of his feathers. So we've been doing as any caring family does when they have an animal that they love in their lives, so, you know, seeking all of the medical attention that we can. We've taken into account all of the recommendations for Merlin. But nonetheless, he continues to show some signs of, well, just not the best well-being. So we've begun looking into some options, and we're really happy to say that we have an excellent option for Merlin. Merlin and all macaws are very, very intelligent creatures. They love to spend time with other macaws, and we don't have other macaws here, and we also don't have a focus in our work for looking after macaws. So and we don't have green spaces, and we don't have veterinarians on staff. But at Safari Niagara, which is where Merlin is going next week, they have all those things. They have other macaws, they have a large number of exotic birds in their care, and they even have a mate that they're hoping Merlin will enjoy the company of. We're really, really excited about this for Merlin because we know that it's going to provide him with really the optimal experience for him, a much more natural setting for him, a family of birds for him to engage with, and he has a long life ahead of him. Merlin, as I said, it will be 22 this year, and macaws in captivity can live 65, 85, even 90 years of age. So he's got a long life ahead of him, and we're really, really happy that he's going to have really the best option that we can possibly imagine for him.
Kim Reinhart is the manager of the Maritime Museum in Halifax. She was joined by Merlin, the museum's parrot. The new book, The Pain Project, started with a very different kind of project. It was the summer of 2008. Simon Paradis was working as a custom home builder on a scaffold in the Sunshine Coast community of Half Moon Bay. Suddenly, part of the scaffold gave way. And when it did, everything came crashing down for Simon and his wife, Kara Stanley. Simon endured catastrophic brain and spinal cord injuries and was paralyzed from the waist down. He spent 19 days in a medically induced coma, and 3 months at a rehab hospital in Vancouver. He set aside his work as a musician, and Kara set aside hers as a writer. Both of them focused on his recovery, until it eventually became clear that they were going to have to learn to live with a new reality, chronic pain. It's a phenomenon that plagues many families and fuels North America's opioid epidemic. And 16 years after his accident, pain still defines Simon and Kara's lives a lot more than they'd like. But the Pain Project is their attempt to turn the tables on pain, to define it, to distill what they've learned and to offer a glimpse of their findings to readers who may be facing similar struggles. The book comes out next week. We reached Kara Stanley and Simon Paradis ahead of its publication at their home in Half Moon Bay.
Kara, Simon, welcome to As It Happens.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. And Kara, you know, you've written about your experiences, Simon's accident before. You spoke about it in the book in 2015. And in that book, you start this book with a quote from that book and your reflections on it now. And you wrote, quote, "Pain is a powerful teacher of how to live in the present moment," unquote. In this book, you call that sentence cringeworthy. Why?
Cringeworthy in that it offered such a tiny snapshot of a much bigger picture. And I still feel that's true, but the reality of what a decade of chronic pain was for Simon, I felt there was more to be said.
And Simon, you know, the new book opens on the 10th anniversary of your accident. It becomes clear that although, you know, you had a recovery, as you write in the book, as you and Kara write, that exceeded expectations, it's certainly still been a difficult 10 years in many ways, and many things are far from resolved. What was happening at that time when this idea for a second book came up?
Well, I think... you know, we were getting to a point where we were feeling both sort of exhausted with the relentlessness of my chronic pain issues, and that we needed to be a little bit more proactive in educating ourselves and thinking about contingencies that would provide a measure of hope and agency moving forward. So collaborating on this project kind of gave us the ability to just build stratas of things that would be help us advocate for ourselves in terms of what pain is, what my experience with it is, you know, what is the social idea of suffering pain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my initial accident, you know, disability is a crash course in vulnerability. So I feel like, you know, it allowed me to also take a measure from that and be available to be vulnerable with regards to my relationship with chronic pain without necessarily being overly scared of it, being able to experience and move through it.
But Simon, you're the one feeling the pain. So when a discussion comes up about, you know, having more discussions about the pain, how do you respond to that?
Well, and I was a little worried about that, you know, because it's this relentless passenger in my life. I was worried that, you know, focusing on a project that just dealt specifically with pain was like doubling down on the experience of suffering from it. Mm. But really, it provided me information moving forward to be able to manage pain incrementally a little bit better.
Yeah.
You know, it was more of a process of focusing on care over cure. Not worry about a singular cure, but to start asking better questions with regards to what we can do to make things better.
And Kara, what was the moment you decided that you wanted to do a second book and try to get those answers? What point were you at after that initial decade that you needed another shift in thinking and action?
I think the experience of pain, ironically, really, because we all experience it. We all have some idea of pain in our lives, but it is a very isolating experience. Simon and I have been together since we were in our early 20s, you know, best friends since we were 15. But there's something about that erosive force of pain that had the ability to, you know, it felt like it was threatening our in-syncness. And that was a scary place for me. And so I think the idea of focusing on a book project or a pain project was just a way of coming at it from a different angle.
And a way of communicating. I mean, I'm so glad you brought up the history of your relationship, because I kept coming back to you as a couple over and over again as I read the book. You know, it's clear you're deeply in love. It's clear you're great communicators, you know. But were you always so communicative? I mean, I think a lot of couples listening who may also read the book will go, you know, we can't not argue about groceries or daycare or whatever, right? And you're having these very calm, very loving, lucid conversations. Like, even if we take into account in a book, you might finesse things a little bit and not reveal everything. It's quite extraordinary. So was that how you always communicated?
I think definitely the accident, you know, coming through spinal cord injury and brain injury required a deeper level of intimacy. I feel like we were very, very close, and we were, you know, thank you for saying that. And I agree. I think we were good communicators as part of a relationship that works. But going through the accident, I think we had to get to a deeper level of intimacy. I think, you know, more so than I could have ever predicted. So I think that helped. And there's a point at the end of the book where I try to acknowledge the fact that a lot of those conversations are conversations that happen over and over and over again, you know, and you can't do that in the book, but they're lessons that you have to learn and relearn over again in the new context that they present themselves.
You start with that very difficult question, that big question, the goal of this book, trying to figure out what is pain. How would you define it now for our listeners? Can you?
I don't think I can. And I think that was a big part of the impulse behind wanting to write the book, that one of the most important things to understand about pain is that it is highly contextual. And what pain is you're going to get a different answer for, you know, different people at different times in history, different places. But having said that, we did try to answer that question from as many different perspectives and angles as we could in the book. That sort of became what the structure was, you know, answering this question over and over again: what is pain, from a biological perspective, but also, you know, what does pain mean to us?
There's that interesting interaction. I found it at the very beginning, and what you land on at the end about, you know, this idea that it's in someone's head, that pain is connected to your brain. And you resist that definition, Simon. For those who haven't read the book, tell our listeners why you really don't like that.
Well, in my experience, I felt like it sort of put the burden of suffering directly on me. Like, I'm essentially the one to blame for having chronic pain. And I kind of felt like it stole my agency and stole my hope to be reduced to that dynamic. And I needed to feel like I could be more proactive in, you know, choosing how to live with pain rather than having pain dictate how I live. I don't know if that makes sense coming at it from that angle.
It does, and I think it underlines something you get at throughout the book and later on in the book as well, Kara, that, you know, people are so often dismissed or not believed. So you do ultimately land on a phrase which pleases everyone and I think is quite strong. Can you tell our listeners how you decide to phrase it that works for Simon and probably a lot of other people as well?
That pain is a product of the nervous system interpreting signals of threat in the environment. It's the nervous system sort of translating threat into pain.
Pain is interpreted by the nervous system, you write. When she first said that, Simon, Was it like a sort of a bolt of lightning? Because it's not saying you're making it up. It's in your head. There's a function happening or a malfunction. Yeah,
definitely. And, you know, and it certainly helped restore a certain amount of my ability to be able to dictate the terms in which I have a relationship with pain, putting in that context.
So throughout the book, you have your steps that you've set out there, and you're trying different things. You're ordering things online to try, every way you can tackle this issue. And mindfulness is one that comes up. It's something I'm certainly familiar with, but it's also something that's often appropriated or co-opted by the wellness movement, and it can put other people off. They don't believe it. How did mindfulness enter the conversation and help you both?
But certainly mindfulness was the word itself was triggering for Simon. He had a couple of very funny rants, small portions of which appear in the book, yeah. Talking about how he feels it's just a word that has been, degraded to meaninglessness through overuse. But it is something that we did return to over and over again. Just, paying attention in the moment, non-judgmentally, and helping to break the cycle, the vicious cycles that we can get into with chronic pain.
And how did you use mindfulness in your daily life, Simon? Once you got over the initial trigger of it all, was it breathing? How did it help you manage your pain?
Well, there were a few things that actually brought me to trying to be in the present moment. I had an experience of doing some guided qigong with someone, which helped. And also I have an Oculus helmet that has a couple of programs on it that are for mindfulness and meditation that are kind of like guided experiences. So you're sort of within almost like a video game type realm. It's a little easier to kind of be engaged. My joke about that was competitive mindfulness. But when I think about the context of mindfulness and chronic pain, what I was experiencing is that as I was in the throes of going through a really bad bout of chronic pain, I realized that it also caused my catastrophic thinking to kind of go into hyper mode. So not only was chronic pain hijacking me in the moment, but it was also forcing me to get worried and anxious about things coming in the future that might also be hijacked by chronic pain. Mm-hmm. And what mindfulness helped me do was to just kind of leave all of that badly predictive noise out of the equation and just center in the moment and kind of just move through the pain in that present moment without worrying about, what the future had to hold, which would just kind of exasperate the anxiety that comes with dealing with chronic pain.
One thing we haven't discussed, Simon, is how big a part of your day, how does it feel and look like to have the kind of pain that you do for people who haven't read the book or haven't interacted with the two of you?
Right. Well, when you go to the doctor will say, on a scale from 1 to 10, I would say that the given background noise of pain in my life is always somewhere between a 5 and a 6 on that scale. And then there are moments where it becomes a 10 or 11. And that's when my day is derailed completely. Mm. As we speak right now, I'm dealing with this kind of weird glowing menace in my lower right back. Mm. And then, or actually not back, but even lower than that, below my level of injury, which is funny because I have no sensation or motor below my level of injury, but that chronic pain.
You are listening to As It Happens, and I'm speaking with Simon Paradis and Kara Stanley, whose new book, The Pain Project, comes out next week. As you're looking for solutions, it's not that you turn your back on traditional medicine by any means. One of the things that you do try is something called nerve ablation. That's the actual destruction of some of the nerve tissue that it was believed to perhaps be contributing to Simon's pain. What was the hope when it came to that surgery?
The hope was that we might get to an underlying cause for Simon's pain. And I think even at the point in the book, we weren't sure that it would be a solution, but we had started to really grapple with this idea that the solution might have to be multi-pronged. And so it seemed possible that the nerve ablation might be one important part of the puzzle. it ultimately wasn't. But at that point in the book, we were really reckoning with the idea that there wasn't going to be one single solution.
And knowing what you know now, if you hadn't tried it, Simon, would it have always lingered in your mind? How do you sit with that decision now?
Actually, it's a really good point. Yes. I know I look back on it now as like I was glamored with like a lottery ticket idea of, you know, I'll go in and do this one procedure and then all pain that I've been suffering for the last decade will be gone. And that was a pretty powerful suggestion, I have to admit. You know, I was I was ready, of course, as you find out reading the book. I bought the T-shirt, I went to the rodeo, and it didn't end up the way that I was hoping. But when you're building a toolkit, you're looking for small incremental advantages. And I felt like, as Kara was saying, that the nerve ablation could be one of a handful of contingencies that would lend to a large percentage of pain reduction. And so I was hoping that it would just be, you know, a part of that toolkit.
The difficult thing about it for Simon and for so many people is that the experience of extreme pain places you in a really desperate position. And certainly when we agreed to the nerve ablation, you know, we did our research, but we were also desperate. And I think that the experience of pain places people in a state of desperation where sometimes you know, you're going to do things that you maybe normally wouldn't have. And again, that was a lot of the impulse behind the book was, okay, what can we do to expand our toolbox of resources for making these decisions, for navigating these really tough choices?
Yeah. In addition to the things we've discussed, the things you're trying, the things you're talking about, there is, of course, medication as well, opioids. Simon, how did your relationship with your medication shift and evolve as you wrote this book and as you worked through this pain project together?
Well, I felt like at first the opioid I was taking was hydromorphone. And I felt like at first what it gave me was it gave me a measure of predictability. When I would go to perform shows with bands and my own concerts and such, it allowed me a chance to have control over the period of time I'd be performing to be able to avoid having a spike that would possibly sabotage the experience of performing for everyone involved. And then eventually what happened was I realized that although I could have some measure of control over small periods of time, like an hour or two, that fundamentally the pain was actually getting worse as I used these over a period of time. And it wasn't working. It wasn't working for me. Instead of taking the pain away from me, it was taking me out of the pain. And so it was important for me at some point to start thinking about other measures rather than pharmaceutical ones.
That quote, I'm glad you said it because it struck me in the book as well, that it takes you out of the pain and not the pain out of you.
Yeah, and I think it created this strange buffer between myself and Kara and our relationship, because I was the person who was having to check out and she was having to manage me both as a feral animal in pain and then this checked out amorphous person hoping to have a brief period of time without pain.
Yeah. And Kara, you use that experience to also discuss, you know, the opioid crisis, which we've reported on many, many times on this show in lots of different jurisdictions, but certainly in British Columbia. So did this experience and your research give you more insight into that crisis and what people who are in different circumstances are dealing with when we talk about opioids, how it got to this point?
Absolutely. And I think one of the big takeaways for me is how the language around opioid use, the opioid crisis, it can get really bogged down in ideology. And I think it's really important to step outside of the politics and look at the people who are experiencing it. One of the big aha moments again for me was I went to a conference in London, England, and there in that global context, the global context of the conference, it was referred to as the North American opioid crisis. And that was a big wake up moment for me and raised really interesting questions that I don't think I have, any answers for really, but the questions are important of, what is it within our North American culture that has maybe left us vulnerable to the kind of free market bad actors like Purdue Pharma, who are pushing this idea that there's a single magic pill to treat all forms of human pain.
Capitalizing on despair, essentially.
Simon, as someone who deals with chronic pain, what do you want other people who, don't have a partner that they worked on a project like this for and maybe are searching for answers? What do you hope this book can offer to other people living with chronic pain?
I hope that it allows people the space to focus more on things that have to do with the notions of care, not necessarily the notions of cure. Mm-hmm. And, that even though we're taught to believe that any measure of feeling uncomfortable is unacceptable, when you're dealing with chronic pain, you kind of have to let pain in and have a cup of tea with it and get to know it to be able to manage it and have some agency over that relationship, So you have to be okay with experiencing pain to be able to deal with pain.
You write in the book, quote, "The opposite of pain is not pleasure so much as it is wonder, vigor, curiosity," unquote. How are you both doing today? How are all of those things part of your day-to-day now?
Do you want to take that one, Bo?
You start that one off.
I think that we are both happy to be releasing the book. There was a lot of focus on pain and sometimes too much. And so being able to shift our focus now to, Simon, to things that bring us pleasure and
hope
and turn some of our energies back into those things.
And what are those? What are some of those things if you want to share?
Cooking nice meals, getting out in the garden, frolicking with the dogs, creating moments, community moments to share with folks, simplifying our life and taking our time with things that matter is a big one. Yeah. As Kara was implying, I think for a while I was a little worried about the project because I didn't necessarily want to build a cathedral to pain in any measure, But, I think a lot of it is slowing down, having open dialogues on the nature of what's going on in the moment and what we're looking forward to, proactively being more hopeful and forward moving,
Ultimately, was this a cathartic experience for both of you, but also an offering, a toolkit for people?
That is exactly what I hope to do with the book. Why write the book? It was really because we were in a place of need. So we, I was trying to address that need in Simon and myself first, but we hoped with the book to be able, through a close look at a singular experience, be able to provide something that was helpful more broadly to people. To sort of look at those things. What were the things, not prescriptive, not, the kind of anecdotal stuff that a lot of chronic people with chronic conditions get bombarded with all the time,
You should try this. Yeah,
you should try this. You should, apple cider vinegar, all of those things. But what we wanted to do was sort of come up with a, a more like a strata level of, resources to add to our toolbox.
Yeah, providing small, as you're saying, Kara, exactly, small incremental values of agency through all of those practices.
We had this matrix of 2%. If something was helping by 2%, it generally stuck around. And we were hoping if we could keep adding 2% after 2% after 2%. And I think that while in the process, often you're not really seeing big shifts or changes because it is these little tiny incremental steps. We did at the end of the project, it seemed reasonable to see some of the big shifts that did occur as a result of all this little tiny work that you do. And it's really a leap of faith because you're not seeing big changes right away.
We are going to leave our listeners, Simon, with one of your songs, which we read about in the book, Sweet Melinda. Set it up a bit for us.
Well, Bob Dylan, who I think is just, of course, a fabulous songwriter and has been a part of my musical experience since I was in my mother's womb, basically. he wrote a song called Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues. And in it, he describes a character called Sweet Melinda. The peasants call her the goddess of doom. She speaks good English and she invites you up to her room. And I always felt like, man, that is a hard characterization to live with, like, for eternity, you know? And so I felt like, let me give an option to writing a song about Sweet Melinda, where she's more of a touchstone of hope and not necessarily, you know, the goddess of doom, which seemed a little heavy at the time for my brain. So anyway, it's a song where I try to reimagine who that person could be.
Kara, Simon, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We reached Kara Stanley and Simon Paradis in Half Moon Bay, BC. Their book, The Pain Project, is published by Greystone Books and comes out next week. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 following Your World Tonight.
You can also listen to our show on the CBC Listen app or online at cbc.ca/AIH. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Lisa Brin-Rundel.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.